Time magazine started its practice of nominating a Man of the Year in 1927 to commemorate Charles Lindbergh's epic solo flight across the Atlantic. Over the years, Time's choice was eclectic, selecting Hitler once and Stalin twice, broadening out into women like the young Queen Elizabeth and into groups such as the astronauts who landed on the moon. But for more than half a century, Time stuck to human beings. That is, until the end of 1982, when its editors chose an inanimate object, the personal computer.
In 1982, a cascade of computers beeped and blipped their way into the American office, the American school, the American home. The information revolution that futurists have long predicted has arrived, bringing with it the promise of dramatic changes in the way people live and work, perhaps even in the way they think. America will never be the same. In a larger perspective, the entire world will never be the same.
Time was right. The PC would transform America and the world. It even played a part in ending the Cold War. The story of how it was developed sheds a revealing light on some fundamental differences between the United States and the Soviet Union. Although Britain has fair claim to have pioneered the computer, it was in the United States that computers made their home. In November 1952, a UNIVAC, short for Universal Automatic Computer, was the sensational centerpiece of CBS's presidential election coverage, when it rightly predicted that Dwight Eisenhower would win a landslide victory on the basis of very early results, and even though opinion polls all suggested a close race. These early computers were dinosaurs, often filling a large office. One was on display at IBM's headquarters in Manhattan. According to a visitor,
"It was a very large machine and contained 23,000 relays and 13,000 valves. The machine in operation must have been the most spectacular in the world. Thousands of neon lamps flashed on and off. Relays and switches buzzed away."
Gradually, everything became smaller. The circuits of thousands of valves were replaced by transistors. These in turn were miniaturized on tiny silicon chips. Such innovations were a tribute to the skill of American engineers and the enterprise of US business, but they also depended on funding from the US government. This was because transistors were hugely attractive to the armed forces for reliable lightweight communication systems in weapons, ships, planes, and missiles. In 1960, despite the teenage craze for transistor radios, nearly half the total American production of semiconductors was bought by the US military. Equally important for national defense were computers themselves. After the Soviets had tested an atomic bomb in 1949, US military planners were alarmed at the nation's vulnerability to air attack. To coordinate information from radar all over the American continent, a vast computing system was needed, known as SAGE, involving 24 regional centers, each with two computers. At around $8 billion, SAGE was the largest and most costly military project of the 1950s, and IBM got the contract. Tom Watson Jr., the company's boss at the time, said later,
"It was the Cold War that helped IBM make itself the king of the computer business. I worked harder to win that contract than I worked for any other sale in my life. Until the late 50s, SAGE accounted for almost half our total computer sales. It enabled us to build highly automated factories ahead of anybody else and to train thousands of new workers in electronics."
By the end of the 1960s, IBM accounted for three-quarters of mainframe computer production across the world. Western countries, America's allies, were able to buy US technology, but Cold War laws imposed tight controls on technology transfer from the US across the Iron Curtain. The Soviets had to rely on industrial espionage to keep up, Most of their computers were modelled on pirated IBM systems, several years out of date. In this vital high-tech battleground of the Cold War, the Soviet Union was falling seriously behind. The IBM computers of the 60s were a far cry from the early dinosaurs, but they still looked like elephants in comparison with the modern computer. Because of their size and cost, they were overwhelmingly built by big business for big business. In 1968, there were fewer than 70,000 computers in use in the whole United States. The critical change was reducing the heart of the computer to a single silicon chip in the form of a microprocessor. This technology was developed at Intel, a California spin-off company in what had become known as Silicon Valley, the high-tech area around San Francisco Bay. Silicon Valley was made possible by a fertile local mix. The resources of Stanford University, several big US military research installations, and the availability of venture capital. These all mattered in the development of the personal computer. But so did something very different: California's distinctive counterculture. The PC was, in fact, a very anti-establishment revolution, born in the youth culture of the Vietnam War era. Its leaders were mostly young enthusiasts who worked in the computer industry or in electronics. Many were captivated by the ideology of computer liberation, whose goal was to take communications out of the grip of the big corporations. The Homebrew Computer Club started in Menlo Park on the edge of Silicon Valley in 1975, became a mecca for enthusiasts keen to experiment with microprocessors. Soon dozens of tiny new computer firms, many of them homebrew offshoots, were competing for the hobbyist market. But one of these managed to turn the personal computer into a mass-market consumer product. This was Apple Computer, founded in California by Stephen Wozniak and Steve Jobs, two local college dropouts with complementary talents, Wozniak being a brilliant nerd, Jobs a charismatic salesman. In 1983, Time magazine reported Wozniak talking about his co-founder.
Steve didn't do one circuit design or piece of code. He's not really into computers. And to this day, he has never gone through a computer manual. But it never crossed my mind to sell computers. It was Steve who said, let's hold them up in the air and sell a few.
Their first Apple computers, not much more than crude circuit boards, were assembled in the Jobs' family garage. But Jobs and Wozniak then developed an Apple II with far greater appeal. A self-contained unit in a plastic case with keyboard, screen and printer, which could be used for correspondence, accounts and other household requirements. This they launched in the spring of 1977, aided by the software packages for spreadsheets and word processing that were now coming onto the market. Apple's motto was one person, one computer, in line with Jobs' counterculture philosophy of democratizing computer power. Some in IBM thought it was all a bit of a joke, one manager scoffing,
"Why on earth would you care about a personal computer? It has nothing to do with automation. It isn't a product for big companies that use real computers."
But this, of course, would prove to be way off target. So belatedly, in August 1981, IBM brought out its own PC. The microprocessor was bought from Intel, setting the company on course for dominance in the market for chips, while the software operating system came from a small Seattle firm called Microsoft, whose founders Bill Gates and Paul Allen were some more computer hobbyists who got started in business by designing software for the Apple II. Microsoft's new software was sold with every IBM machine. This was Bill Gates's big break. Between 1980 and 1982, sales of PCs quadrupled to 2.8 million a year, hence Time magazine's accolade. Other companies rushed to produce IBM-compatible machines, most also being sold with Gates' software. And in the process, the US computer market was totally transformed. In 1978, about three-quarters of sales had been mainframes. By 1984, less than half. The computer was moving from government and corporations into small businesses and the home. The information revolution had begun. One sign of this revolution was in America's booming financial markets. By the mid-1980s, the NASDAQ, or National Association of Securities Dealers Automated Quotations, had become the third largest stock exchange in the world, and all competitors had to follow its computerized methods. Computer networks had been pioneered by the US military, but thanks to the PC, they were soon spinning off into American society as a whole. One benefit was in communications, electronic mail. But equally important was the mass of information being organized by the late 1980s through the World Wide Web. The US government wanted this available to all Americans, Vice President Al Gore declaring in 1994,
"We must make sure that all children have access. That's not the case now. 22% of white primary school students have computers in their homes. Less than 7% of African-American children do. We can't create a nation of information haves and have-nots. The on-ramps to the information superhighway must be accessible to all."
Behind the Iron Curtain, such revolutions were impossible. The weakness of the consumer economy was a complete block on PC development, while the computer youth culture that nurtured entrepreneurs like Steve Jobs and Bill Gates was totally inconceivable in the Soviet bloc. So too was the information revolution, because information is power, and under communism, both were tightly controlled. In 1986, one computer designer in communist Czechoslovakia lamented the growing penetration of Western PCs.
"With these computers comes not only technology, but also ideology. Children might soon begin to believe that Western technology represents the peak and our technology is obsolete and bad. In 10 years' time, it will be too late to change our children. By then, they will want to change us."
So the PC and the information revolution posed a double challenge to the Soviet bloc, economic and ideological. Mikhail Gorbachev, the new Soviet leader from 1985, was seriously worried, and George Shultz, Ronald Reagan's Secretary of State, played on his concern. Shultz kept warning Gorbachev,
"Closed and compartmentalized societies cannot take advantage of the information age. The Soviet economy will have to be radically changed to adapt to the new era."
The hope of sharing in the American-led information revolution was a major reason why Gorbachev was so anxious to forge a new relationship between the Soviet Union and the United States. But he was playing with fire, because the new openness he craved would destroy the old Soviet Union.